This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The most famous whistleblower of the 20th century, Daniel Ellsberg, who changed the course of the Vietnam War by releasing the Pentagon Papers, recounts his experiences as a whistleblower and gives his thoughts on Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst who provided archives of secret military documents to WikiLeaks in 2010, exposing our government's lies about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are deeply grateful for him spending some time with us. And I do want to begin with some of your own sense about your journey and why the issue of freedom for whistleblowers, freedom of speech, is such a hallmark of what at least is an effort to accomplish democracy within a society.
I identify with Chelsea Manning and with Ed Snowden. We went through the same trajectory of first feeling that the most patriotic and useful thing we could do was to serve the executive branch or the military of the U.S. government, and came to realize that that could contradict our duties as a citizen and our sworn oaths to uphold and support the Constitution of the United States. We found ourselves participating in policies that were very contradictory to our own Constitution and to our national security and to our welfare. These policies were criminal. That goes on in every administration and in every government to a considerable extent. And they were being conducted in secret, and we were being expected to keep those secrets as well as participate in those policies. That contradicted our oath to support and defend the Constitution. At the time, I wasn't too conscious of the obligations I'd assumed under the Constitution. I didn't really think it applied to me because I worked for the President. Oh, I worked for the Secretary of Defense, who was working for the President. And we didn't really think of ourselves as bound by laws, treaties, any more than the President did. And as I said, we came to realize, each of us, that that was inconsistent with the welfare of our own country. And in the case of Vietnam, we were pursuing an unjustified war, killing people in Vietnam and sending Americans to kill and be killed for no justifiable, legitimate reason. That, to me, came to seem murder, unjustified homicide. And it was something I should not participate in at all anymore, and I should expose it and try to stop it. That was in 1969, and I knew that the war was going to continue under Richard Nixon. I knew that because I'd worked for Richard Nixon at the beginning of his administration, late 68, before he came into office, and consulted from the RAND Corporation. And I had contacts then in the White House and elsewhere in Vietnam that gave me the inside knowledge that Nixon was making threats that were going to prolong the war and expand it, which is what did happen. To try to avert that, I finally decided to follow the example of young draft resistors who were going to prison, some of whom I met. I think that was crucial to my own change. And they were going to prison to protest a war that they and I saw as wrong. And it made me realize that if I wanted to shorten this war or end it as I did, I was ready to go to prison since they were. I followed their example. So I copied 7,000 pages of top secret documents on the decision making in Vietnam. That was the title of it, from 1945 to 1968. It ended before the current president, Nixon, came into office, so it didn't incriminate him directly. But I knew that he was following in the paths of his four predecessors, and he was lying to the public as to what he was doing. And he was making threats that were going to expand the war as they had done. So I hoped that by revealing that past record, it might make people more skeptical and probing of his policy, and it might lead them to end it. Actually, it didn't do that. People were not willing to extrapolate from the past presidents, four of them, to the current one, even if they hadn't voted for him. They didn't want to believe that the president currently could be really lying to him, even if his predecessors had been. In that respect, I didn't find success. Ironically, Nixon was so worried that I would reveal secrets about his administration and perhaps documents that people inside his National Security Council had given to me, that he took criminal actions to shut me up. He went into my former psychoanalyst's office to get information to blackmail me into silence, wiretapped me without a warrant, overheard me on warrantless wiretaps of others. He sent people to incapacitate me on the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, 1972. All these were crimes which he had to cover up and which he could pretty well count on covering up as a president, but his luck ran out. Some of the very people who'd been involved in this were caught in the Watergate doing other crimes for him in connection with the campaign. He had to keep them silent by bribing them into silence and perjury. Those were new crimes of obstruction of justice, the kind of thing that the current president is accused of right now. We haven't seen the evidence on it, but that's what's in the air right now, and so we could see a similar history. The effect of that was when that was in fact exposed, because the people in the Watergate were caught and eventually did come clean. After some of them did, the others began revising their testimony, and Nixon was faced with impeachment and even prosecution and led to resign, and that made the war endable. So this was a case where what they now call whistleblowing, where truth-telling of misdoing, of wrongdoing within an agency or a government or a corporation is exposed to authorities or to the public in order to change these misdeeds. This is a case where what I did was a link in a chain of events that led to the shortening of the war. So it was a success. I thought that success might encourage other people to do the same. In the end, I wasn't imprisoned by an almost miraculous set of revelations, which I've just described. Nobody could count on that sort of thing. But I did think that people could see that it was worth taking a risk to enlighten the public about the truth in order to shorten the war or to prevent major governmental crimes, as Ed Snowden revealed in connection with criminal surveillance of people. That didn't happen. 39 years went by, and although there were leaks, and many of them were very useful, they were very limited. They didn't have the wholesale revelations that are really necessary to prove a case. Until Chelsea Manning, 39 years later, I'd almost given up that anybody would do what I'd done, essentially. Chelsea Manning did do that. She faced life in prison, even the possibility of capital punishment in her case in the military, and did serve 7.5 years in prison until President Obama commuted her sentence. Then 3 years later, after she did that, Ed Snowden revealed an even larger amount of information about illegal surveillance by the National Security Agency. And that made people aware in the world for the first time of the massive scale of this Big Brother type of surveillance by not only the American government, but other governments as well. So, and Chelsea had significant impact also in her revelations. So although she paid a very heavy price, and she's, of course, now back in jail for refusing to participate in what is basically an assault by this administration on the freedom of the press, targeting WikiLeaks, to which she had given her information, including a video called Collateral Murder, which I encourage people to look up on YouTube, Collateral Murder, which shows acts of murder by a helicopter crew of unarmed civilians in a ground below them in Iraq, of a kind that took place every day, essentially, by reports of other people in Iraq, and revealed a number of other things. They want her now to speak to a grand jury that is trying to find some grounds on which to indict Julian Assange in particular and other people connected with WikiLeaks. There are grounds put to their hand there. There have been reports that he might be indicted, Julian, on the same grounds I was. I was the first to be indicted for revealing information to the American people and the first prosecution under the Espionage Act or theft. But they're not anxious to do that to a journalist because it so clearly contradicts the First Amendment, freedom of the press, as well as freedom of speech. They'd prefer to find other grounds. And I think they're hoping to get Chelsea to add to her many, many hours of previous testimony under oath in ways that would maybe enable them to think up some new charges to bring against him that would not apply to the New York Times. Because basically what she did was what I did in 71 in giving information to the New York Times. She offered it to the New York Times, by the way, before she went to WikiLeaks, and also to the Washington Post, to which I had also given the Pentagon Papers 39 years earlier. But they both turned their noses up at that. They didn't pick up on it. So she went to WikiLeaks. There is, I think, the government investigation now of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange is a first step toward indicting and prosecuting and imprisoning, if possible, journalists and publishers. Julian is essentially a publisher, and not just sources like me or Chelsea or Ed Snowden. After my case, there were exactly two other cases before President Obama. One of those was dismissed, as mine was dismissed for governmental misconduct. Obama tripled that score, had 9 prosecutions, but they were still all old sources, not of journalists. And the Obama administration backed off from indicting WikiLeaks or Julian Assange on the realization that they'd really done nothing that the New York Times hadn't done in publishing these very facts and revelations, and the Post and the Guardian and a lot of other papers. And the Obama administration chose not blatantly to violate the First Amendment by going after the press. Trump is less restrained by that concern. But even he and his DOJ, Department of Justice, wants to find other basis, if he can, that will not apply to the New York Times, to find some indication that Assange or WikiLeaks overstepped the bounds of journalism in some way by encouraging the leak of classified information, by specifically helping Chelsea break codes or do something. Advice she didn't, help she did not need and did not get, and she's sworn otherwise. But they would like testimony that contradicts her earlier testimony. It doesn't have to be true. In effect, they're torturing her by putting her back in jail. Not only her, you know, a lot of people are tortured by being in solitary, for example. But it's torture trying to get what torture gets, which is false confessions. That's what it does do and what it's used for and can often be effective. That doesn't always work. And it won't work on Chelsea. But putting her back in jail will be a cautionary example to other people who might move in her direction, and of which I would say there should be more. We need more, not less whistleblowers. But that's not the attitude of any government. And they're putting her back in now, I think, as part of this process, which she refuses to be party to. She's one of the most patriotic people and conscientious people I've ever heard of or known in this country. And I admire her very much. She's a hero of mine, as is Snowden, who is in essentially permanent exile for doing what Chelsea did or for what I did. I hope there will be a public awareness that this process against the press is an attack on our democracy. It's on our basic rights and what makes us a democratic republic. If they are successful in getting a conviction of Julian Assange, the New York Times will not be too far behind that, and the free press will be a thing of the past.
Danielle Ellsberg, I want to mention that Chelsea Manning said, "I will not participate in a secret process that I morally object to, particularly one that has been historically used to entrap and prosecute activists for protected political speech." And that is, of course, referring to resisting the grand jury. I wonder about your thoughts on the grand jury process that has so often been used to decapitate, smash people who are powerless, their organization, or people such as yourself and Chelsea who resist the collective oppression or silencing of people who wish to reveal the truth of a society.
I believe I've become more educated on that problem just in the last few days than I was earlier, because I looked up the history of grand juries a bit on the web and learned quite a bit from that, more than I knew before, about the way they have been used to repress, for example, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, and other activist movements in this country and elsewhere. I didn't realize that grand juries were as problematic as Chelsea was aware, apparently. And that's the case. So she is protesting a process that is very often abused, and in this case is being abused, in order, as I say, to rescind the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, significantly. This is the first president who has openly declared the press the enemy of the people, an expression used both by the Nazis and by Stalin against dissenters in their authoritarian societies. And it's fairly brazen of Trump actually even to quote that very ill-famed phrase, enemy of the people. Other presidents have regarded the press as their personal enemies in some way. Nixon thought that way, but he said it on the tapes. He said it in private and not as a public theme. So it's a warning cry to us that we hear our president actually taking that position. And Chelsea is directly challenging it. I wouldn't respect her less if she, under face of going to prison, actually went ahead and participated, as others have and others will. But I admire her all the more, as I did before, for being that principled, to be willing to go back to jail, where she had a very hard time for 7.5 years, for being willing to go back to that rather than participate in this process.
Do you think that the issue of freedom of press or government lying to its citizenry is, are we in a more fragile state now? Are we in as perilous a condition as we were during the Vietnam War, or perhaps even more so? I'm interested in your sense of where the protections of our Constitution are at this juncture in time and under this administration.
I'm not sure that Trump actually lies on important matters more than other presidents. They all did, the ones I worked for, and all of them did, and not just in this country. As the journalist I.F. Stone used to say, all government officials lie and nothing they say is to be believed. Meaning, not that they lie in everything they say, although Trump comes pretty close to that, he's unusual there, but that anything they say may be a lie, and it's not the last word. It needs to be checked against other evidence, and in some cases that evidence can only be people who are willing to tell the truth at risk to their own careers. But now, what's the difference now? Well, we have a president now who lies so frequently and so blatantly that it's not even an insult to call him a liar anymore. In the olden days, I think I know that I would have been thrown off of a radio program if I called the president a liar. Well, that hasn't been true since Watergate, really, or since the Pentagon Papers. It's certainly not true now. So we take it as a matter of course. But in terms of lying on important matters, not the size of crowds or something, but on matters of planning for war or reasons for going to war, that has always been a major problem, and it is one today. If we go to war against Iran, which would be a catastrophe in many ways, as well as a major crime against peace, the reasons given would be as false as they were for Vietnam or Iraq. And obviously that is a major danger right now, with Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton having been, his career has almost been based on trying to promote a war with Iran. We do need to rely on whistleblowers really revealing that, and other people speaking honestly and freely about the situation, and press that is willing to challenge the president's policy, as the Times did not in the case of Iraq or in Vietnam until the Pentagon Papers. So the press doesn't have a wonderful record on that, but there are times when they have taken the risk, even of prosecution, as in the Pentagon Papers case, and as they will be doing now under this president. There have been times when they've risen to that challenge and conducted what amounted to civil disobedience, in the sense of defying an attorney general who said this is dangerous to the safety of the United States, as they said in the case of the Pentagon Papers, falsely, or the case of Chelsea Manning, where they have not come up with a single instance where anything she revealed actually harmed anyone or harmed the legitimate interests of the United States. They would have love to come up with that, and they weren't able to. If we are to be a country where the people are sovereign in an ultimate sense and have the ability to make informed decisions and that influence the actual course of events, and that's true here only to a limited extent, but it is true to a limited extent, and that's more than a lot of other countries in the world, and that's worth one's life to preserve, I would say. As Snowden put it, there are some things worth dying for, as Chelsea Manning said directly to her informant, the one who informed on her, she was willing to go to prison for life or even be executed, she said, to put out this information. So that's a spirit that I felt that I identify with, and I believe it's true today. We need that truth-telling today, and we always will.
Your thoughts on the incredible saber-rattling of the U.S. against, indeed it would seem far more than saber-rattling, against Venezuela, and the press fanning the flames of war, similarly for regime change in Venezuela. How do you understand and look at that, as you certainly become for years now known as a major peace activist?
It is a serious situation. There is actual talk and prospect of the U.S. sending combat troops to Venezuela, which would be the first time we've ever exerted our imperial influence in that way in South America. We've done it very often in Central America. I don't know of an instance where we've done what is clearly being threatened right now, which is to send troops to South America in circumstances that they don't even pretend involve any threat to the security of the United States. So it would be clearly a crime against the peace. In terms of our intervention there now, the talk of regime change, our policy in the world for a long time, but certainly in the whole post-war period, has been one of intervention and covert intervention, generally clandestine, in pursuit of regime change of countries whose governments did not serve very specifically U.S. corporate interests. What is new is that both parties and a lot of our allies are actually talking openly about our right and our need to conduct regime change. That's mind-boggling even for me, and I'm not exactly naive on this. I'm very familiar with that inside belief that that was our right and our need in many countries in the world, covertly, and lying about it, denying it, keeping it secret, relying on whistleblowers to reveal that that was our intention. Here, it doesn't take a whistleblower to say that both parties are talking about bringing about regime change, possibly with military means. That is the definition of empire, and we generally think of ourselves wrongly as non-imperial and as believing in self-determination everywhere, which has never been true in the Third World in particular, in the former colonial areas. We haven't been that blatant about it, as I say, in South America. We really have been pretty blatant in Central America, although even so, most people don't realize how much we were involved in Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua. These other things were done clandestinely. This ties in with an instance of mixed performance by the media as well as the government. For once, the New York Times has revealed that they were mistaken earlier. They conveyed false information that the Maduro government had burned aid shipments and trucks specifically on a bridge going to Venezuela. At some point, they looked again, or they looked at newly released videos and noticed that it was so-called protesters, not the government, who had thrown firebombs, Molotov cocktails, that had caused the fire. But meanwhile, the media just across the board had cooperated right away in accepting government claims that the Maduro government had done this. This is obviously, by the way, as a basis for justifying military intervention. The kind of false information like the Tonkin Gulf incidents in August of 1964, which led to 9 years of bombing of North Vietnam, began at that point. Well, here is a case where there was misinformation conveyed, and I think it's a very fair question to ask, how long was it that the government knew that that information was false before they allowed it to be known to the public? And for another matter, who were the protesters who threw the firebombs at all? I'm not saying that I know who they were. I'm saying that I think it's a very fair question to ask now, to say, who were they? Who were they serving? Who paid them? What was going on here? Because we have a situation where the leaders of our government in an almost unprecedented way, are talking about possible military intervention in a country that where we don't even pretend to have a security interest in that situation. That shows where we've come to in the way of accepting an imperial role in the world in the nuclear age. That is extremely dangerous to the survival of civilization, humanity. Not in Venezuela directly. That's just a small part of a policy that is extremely reckless in the world. And by the way, we're not the only ones who do that, who act that way. It's dangerous on all sides. So more truth-telling, more democracy than we have right now is called for, I think, if we're to go on.
As we wrap up, Mr. Ellsberg, again, your thoughts about Chelsea Manning and bringing Chelsea Manning back to the beloved community.
The objections she's making to the grand jury process are very valid in general, although there no doubt have been some cases where a grand jury acted legitimately, and there's some areas, perhaps against organized crime, where it has served a legitimate purpose. It is now clearly serving the illegitimate purpose of attempting to silence dissent and to silence the free press generally. She is acting heroically, I would say, Chelsea Manning, in a willingness to go to jail to expose and protest participation in this process against the free press. And I think in her own case, as a person who had surgery recently, special needs, who asked actually for house arrest after being charged with contempt because of her medical needs, to send her back into jail where those needs will not be met, even if the government made a good faith effort to meet those needs. They won't be met in jail. And obviously that doesn't apply only to her, it applies to many other people. But in her case, we have a case of a patriot acting heroically in our interests, and certainly a campaign of which I'm part to free Chelsea Manning gets wide support.
Daniel Ellsberg, for your lifetime of work towards peace and justice, towards equal rights and justice, and to bring about the promise of democracy, thank you so much for spending time with us. You are extremely gracious and very much appreciated.
Well, thank you. And, of course, I appreciate your ability there to bring public light to the injustice that's being done to Chelsea. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Much appreciated, sir.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.